Sylvia and me.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hello, this is Anna Polonsky. I'm a classical pianist, a chamber musician, a piano professor at Vassar College, and a mom of a six-year-old. Please welcome to the Sylvia and Me podcast.
Anna, thank you so much for joining me here today. According to the New York Times, Ms. Polonsky is a strong, sure partner, a chamber musician of exceptional refinement. You've traveled all over the United States, Europe, Asia, and you've also been a frequent guest at the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. So aside from all of that, what I'd like to find out, how did you discover your love of music? When did that start? Because I read something that you were able to read music before you could read words.
Yes, well, thank you for your kind words and thank you, New York Times, for the kind words that you quoted. I grew up in a musician family. Both my father and mother and twin sister are professional musicians. So I grew up in a family that played music from the day I was born. And in fact, I didn't even know that other people's parents, other little schoolmates' parents did something else, like were doctors or engineers or whatnot, because the first question that we would ask anyone about their parents is what their parents played, what instruments they played. That's how narrow my sisters and my understanding of the world was. So there was always music playing, and I think there probably had not been any question in my parents' mind that my sister and I should start playing instruments when we came of age, which is around 4 or 5. I think it is a very difficult question for any parent, but especially of a parent of a child who does demonstrate some kind of proclivity towards a talent in art, or be it music or whatever else, about how to go about the training. You need early intensive training to amount to anything in an art as physical as music. You need those reflexes to start building from a very, very early age. So that is always a tough conundrum to solve, how you provide your little tiny kid with a balanced childhood and yet pay homage to what you think is their little musical gift.
I can just imagine that, because you went to school and you were around other children, and to be able to have that balance of that intense training that one needs to become what you've become. How did your parents give you some of both worlds?
Well, to give them their due, they did their best. Since they were both musicians, they also had a very, serious understanding of this work, and much less knowledge of anything else, I think, in life. So they provided us with the best training that in the field that they knew so much about. They were practicing with us from day one. They sent, and I say us, of course, I'm not the royal we Nicholas II, but my twin sister and I, who is now a professional musician as well. They sent us to who they thought were the best teachers, and they enrolled us in a very, very specialized music school in Moscow, where we grew up. where all the other children were also professional little music trainees. We really were isolated in this music training bubble from the very beginning. And again, I'm going to say we had really little understanding that other people were doing other things. So we we didn't really know to mind it if we did mind it. And of course, we did mind it. We hated practicing. We, you know, acted out. there was
just like children always do.
Yeah, parents were frustrated with us. This was our profession, and we truly, I don't think, knew better that it could have been any different.
Was the piano always your instrument?
Well, my mother is a pianist and my father is a violinist. My sister ended up being a violinist. And I think it was between those two instruments that they were sort of dividing between us. I think my sister from the beginning showed a better sort of sympathy towards the violin, and I was kind of left with the piano. I was the bigger twin. We're fraternal twins, and so I think just by virtue of the size of the instrument, the piano went to me and the violin went to her. But I'm really thrilled that was the luck of the draw for me, because I couldn't imagine playing anything else. I could imagine singing, but unfortunately, that's for my next life. I wish I was a singer.
Okay. You know, you never know.
That's true.
You never know. So, as you were saying, you were kind of, you were that bubble, and with all the other children who were in the same bubble, so you really didn't know that there was any other world out there, that you might have been missing out on other things that children who didn't go to a school that specialized in
correct
music. When did you arrive in the States?
It was in 1990, and I will date myself by saying I was 12 years old. We moved to Columbus, Ohio, where my father had secured a job as a violinist in the Columbus Symphony Orchestra, where, in fact, he still continues to work. He's a violinist. He moved the entire family. It was, relatively speaking, compared to other immigrant families, ours was a much smoother transition. Of course, I'm sure my parents had to move mountains to do it, but still, we came into a paycheck. We had a work visa for my father that, you know, could have moved his entire family. We did it in a pretty civilized way, I think, judging by the other stories that I hear. And when we came to Columbus, we enrolled in a normal kids middle school, and suddenly we're thrust into a very normal American teenager lifestyle, which was I'm going to speak for myself, a huge shock to me, and also I think a huge shock to my parents. There wasn't very much knowledge of English in the family. The culture shock was enormous. We don't forget, it was before Soviet Russia ended as a country, so we didn't really know much about the ways of the Western world. The things that come naturally to American kids, like what is a microwave, or is there such a thing as grapes without seeds? Trivial things like that, cultural traditions, ways of acting, ways of dressing, something we had to learn from scratch. And I'm going to admit, it was quite difficult at first to have been immigrants from Eastern Europe who were classical music nerds in a Columbus middle school as a teenager.
That's got to be, especially as a teenager, so tough. First of all, the culture's so different. And you're talking the 1990s. You're lucky you had your sister, but how did the two of you really adapt to the schools and make friends here? Because I'm sure that in addition to that shock was that you were incorporating all of the training that you needed to keep up with.
Well, our parents continued with enrolling us in lessons. And for some time, we even traveled up to the Cleveland Institute of Music, 2 hours north, for weekly lessons, or I think biweekly lessons. And so that continued on track. But the social element was pretty much entirely lacking. We did learn English quickly enough, I think, as kids do. At some point, I think I was 15 or 16, I said, enough of this, and I enrolled myself in the Interlaken Arts Academy up in the northern part of mainland Michigan, and that's a boarding art school where I just enrolled myself as a boarding student. And there was basically where I considered my life having begun again. There were like-minded kids there who were into the arts, and it was just me without parents. And so I felt a sense of personal liberation, as one would when one is 15, 16. And I spent my junior year there. After 1 year there, I decided that the same year I learned about the existence of the Curtis Institute of Music, which is, I think, the premier music conservatory in the world, if I may say my personal opinion about it. I learned about its existence, and I auditioned for it, and completely by a stroke of unbelievable fortune, for which I don't even know how to thank my lucky stars, I got in, and I dropped out of high school and moved to Philadelphia the next year, and that set me on the truly professional track that I am still on now.
Well, that's very, very courageous for a young girl, a teenager, to not only make that move, but to know that what you needed and what you wanted was not where you were, and you went and took it upon yourself to enroll and go to the Interlaken Arts Academy, then to drop out and go to the Curtis Institute. I mean, that takes a lot of gumption, a lot of courage to actually do that. I mean, that's telling other young people out there, if you really want something, you can really go after it.
That's very kind of you to say, but I wonder if I can posit that rather than me stepping out or one stepping out of one's, you know, presumed track and trying something different, one is basically forced by the necessity of the situation to change, where one truly feels that one is at a dead end somewhere, and when you're at a dead end, you have nowhere else to go but somewhere different, right?
But not everyone can do that. A lot of people, especially at that age, a lot of people would say, well, there's no place else for me to go. I don't know what to do, so I'll just stay. Whereas the dead end for you brought you on, you knew there was something else.
Yeah, I thank you for saying that. I think that a lot of the decisions in my life were made just by virtue of me not going anywhere in one place and feeling almost forced to change course, rather than me imagining something like a rosy dream that I work for. But I guess, but probably from the outside, it's all part of the same thing.
You got into the Curtis Institute of Music under the tutelage of the renowned pianist Peter Serkin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and then you went on to earn your master's degree from Juilliard.
Correct.
How was that? How did that feel, graduating from Curtis and then going on to Juilliard? So many people dream of that. They don't get in, they dream of it. You got in and you got your master's from there.
Yeah. Well, disabuse you of any ideas about Juilliard and Curtis. Curtis was the school to get into. That is the most selective, actually, college in the world. There's the U.S. News and World Report, when they come out every year with their ranking of the hardest colleges to get into. Curtis is always number one because they, even of those that deign to audition, only some minuscule percent gets in. It's a school of about 150 to 180 people in all, and who are all there on full scholarship, and you get there exclusively on merit, and everybody basically who comes there already has a career on a professional track. So that was my romantic educational dream. I felt so free. I felt so inspired. The colleagues around me, who are the same colleagues around me now, who in the professional world were so gifted in so many different ways and so individualistic. And being that it was such a small school, you really felt very coddled and very paid attention to, and your talent was sort of individually honed. So that was really a happy time in my life and very artistically rich time in my life. I learned most of what I know, I think, at Curtis, or while I was at Curtis. And then Curtis, unfortunately, doesn't offer master's degrees. So otherwise, I think everybody would just stay there and live there forever. And so if one wants a master's degree, which I thought I needed, one goes elsewhere, and usually one just goes 2 hours north to New York City to do that. And that was also another culture shock. That Juilliard is a huge place and much more anonymous than Curtis. And you learn sort of musical life lessons there that you don't learn being, cuddly and fuzzy at Curtis. You learn kind of just to fight for yourself and stand up for your career and make your mark.
Life lessons.
Yes.
If you're going to go out there in the big world.
The Juilliard School of Hard Knocks. So that was educational in its own right. I had an amazing piano teacher there as well, Jerome Lowenthal, who is a musical light and fostered many wonderful pianists. It was a different perspective on the world, and I networked and I learned a lot. And at some point, I started working, supplementing my income by working at Curtis as a staff pianist, which is to say, I'd play with instrumentalists, non-pianists, for their lessons at Curtis, and I would spend half the week at Juilliard and half the week back in Philadelphia, earning money for Juilliard, also just learning also back from the same professors at Curtis that I left just a year ago.
What is the first real memorable moment, that whether it was your first concert, whether it be a soloist or chamber, that really made you go, wow? Do you have one of those wow moments?
Oh, wow, this is fun. I think it's either something, I played maybe for a school tour when I was 8 back in Moscow. Like, wow, that's the life. Like, I go on stage, they clap for me, they bring me flowers. I could use that. Or if it's something like from the adult part of my life, one of my favorite experiences among many, many, many experiences was when the famed Guarneri Quartet, string quartet, decided to retire, I think in the early 2000s at this point, maybe late 2000s. And they decided that for their last year of touring, they would invite a guest artist to play a quintet with them on the second half of every concert, or just about every concert they played. And they invited pianists that they spent careers with playing to play piano quintets with them, or clarinetists, and so forth. And one of the invited persons was I. And I played, I remember playing the Schumann Quintet with them for their last concert in Philadelphia. And just the sheer honor standing next to these guys, like me, pipsqueak compared to what they, you know, had seen in their professional lives. It was just so validating, and the musical experience was so just magical. I remember kind of walking on clouds throughout the whole rehearsal period. I think so much of what we musicians do, or maybe all artists do, is basically tied into our ego, and we spend our lives trying to humble ourselves in the service of the greater art, and to subtract our own sort of the sense of our person from what the composer might have wanted. But at the same time, none of what we do would come across had we not had a sense of inner balance and inner confidence in our personal understanding of the musical score and our own faith in our expression on stage. And so we spend our lives trying to balance these two basically opposing concepts. And I remember that coming into vivid relief during that experience and other experiences of that sort in my adult concert life.
It sounds absolutely amazing. I know that I've read that in the spring of 2007, you performed a solo recital at Carnegie Hall's Stern Auditorium. The talent you have is phenomenal, and I had the pleasure of actually hearing you in person a few years ago, as I mentioned before, at a place in Fairfield, Connecticut, and I was blown away by your talent. In addition to your touring, you're also, I believe that you also serve on the piano faculty at Vassar College. You're involved with a number of chamber music festivals during the summer.
Yes. Every other summer I attend my sort of other home away from home, which is the Marlborough Music School and Festival in Marlborough, Vermont, something like 25 minutes away from the metropolis of Brattleboro near the New Hampshire border. And it's a sort of a premier chamber music festival with that sort of runs in the philosophy of equalizing the relationship between elder mentors and younger up-and-coming talents. You come together in chamber music groups, which is to say trios, quartets, quintets, sextets, and up, and you work on pieces for an extended period of time, much more extended than you would normally get during your regular concert season. We're talking 2 or 3 or 4 weeks even sometimes, where you just take a piece apart and put it back together and form a relationship with a given piece like you never could in a much more fast-paced world. And you do it with younger people, like I was when I started attending this festival, and in combination with older people like I am now.
I'm a senior
member there. You sort of come together as equals, and you pour in your own perspectives into this thing. And it's kind of a outside of human romantic relationships, spouses or whatever, this is the closest it can come to forming a loving or sometimes not so, sometimes antagonistic relationship with one's fellow humans. It's a relationship on a level beyond words, beyond conversation, beyond just small talk. Very, very spiritual.
It sounds fantastic. I understand that, I think it was last year, you perform in a trio with David Schifrin, plays clarinet, and cellist Peter Wiley.
Yes, these are two gentlemen who are considerably older than I am. So at some point they had been, well, they still are, but at some point they were my mentors, as you know, elder, more experienced musicians. and these are two musicians I adore beyond words. The most special music making of anyone, and I feel in personally just the right approach to playing chamber music, which is again a combination of incredible humility and devotion to finding the truth in the music one plays, combined with unbelievable artistry and just mastery of their instruments. And so when we play together, I feel so, yesterday in the concert, we were playing, one of the pieces we programmed was the Brahms clarinet trio, cello, clarinet, piano. And in the second movement, which is this magical, serene, sublime piece of music, there's a point where I cannot help myself, but I'm near tears every time we play this and any concert, and I am just subsumed, drowned by a sense of just gratitude and the beauty of the music and the gratitude for what I do and the importance of this moment on stage with these two guys for me, and it all kind of just gels together. And I think if anyone, I'm not particularly a religious person, or not at all a religious person, but if that's what a religious experience is, then like I get it. I get the guys who are.
The passion that you have is absolutely fabulous. I could hear it in your voice. I mean, it's sensational and contagious. That's the word I was looking for. That passion is contagious.
Thank you. But I think everybody deserves to feel so transported. And I got it. Wish that everyone in the world could sit there with me and be me on stage and during the return of the theme and the Brahms second movement in a different key, in that different key that it returns in, and just feel the way I do, because my God, like, money cannot buy that kind of feeling.
You know, at the beginning, when you introduced yourself, you also said that you're a mom. In fact, you're a single mom to a 6-year-old little girl. How do you manage everything that you're doing being a single mom? That can't be easy.
I don't know. Manage is, I think, a big word for what's going on here. I think I tread water more like I'm drowning every day. And then I bring myself up. I'm a divorced mom. My daughter is primarily with me most of the time. There is a whole core of babysitters and nannies that cycle through her and my life regularly. There's a lot of organizational work that goes into it, collaging all these caregivers and my schedule and her father's schedule when he is around, her school, her activities, all of that. But I knew it wasn't going to be easy, but
it's never easy, but you do it. But what I want to ask you is, does she have any of your talent or passion? Do you serenade her at night or anything? I mean,
God, that's stuff for her nightmares. Thank you. serenading. I'm only an aspiring singer, not that. She's so spirited, and I can tell she's incredibly musical, and she's right now showing interest in the visual art. She draws a lot, but you know, I have not really formed a concrete philosophy on this, and perhaps I should do better by maybe reading books on those subjects, to which my hands just have not reached. But I see, I remember my childhood, and back then, I didn't know that there were other types of childhood that could be happening to me. I thought, the childhood is practicing the piano and listening to your musician parents practice their instruments, and going to concerts and playing concerts. My first point of business is to keep her stable and happy and confident in her own person, and not to put too much pressure on her outside of like what's required by school or, you know, just social things. And she's a child.
Be a child.
Yeah, be a child. She's a child of divorce, so perhaps I'm overcompensating on the pressure bit, because I want her to just survive that and be happy. And
as single parents, we do that a lot.
Yeah.
yes. But let me tell you, I think that your passion is, as I remember the word, contagious. I'll repeat the fact that I think your playing is sensational. I mentioned that I had the pleasure of hearing you in person. And
thank you.
Keep doing what you're doing, because it's absolutely wonderful. Your story of how you got here and your drive to not have those dead ends be that, but to actually go forward and be this amazing talent. I think you're a true role model for a lot of young musicians and people with an artistic talent. So, Anna, I want to thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me. It's such a pleasure.
If you had one thing that you wanted to tell aspiring musicians, what would you want that to be?
I do. And I would like to say that I will not sound like those career coaches one gets now at conservatories who come and say, well, this is what you should do for your career. You enter these such and such competitions. This is what your publicity photo should look like. This is the kind of connections you should be making. All of that is true and good and wonderful and whatever. But I think we get so buried under the stress of these dry, prescriptive, strategies, that sometimes we forget that it is, as artists, our passion and our love of what we do is what people see first. When you walk out on stage, or when you paint your painting, or when you write your poem, unless you truly derive pleasure from it and just are grateful for the gift, and unless it shows in your life as a driving force for you, I think all of these other wonderful measures would only do so much. And when I see other artists who manifest in their being how much happiness and gratitude their art and instills in them, that is the entire game, I feel, for me. And I think those kind of people make the world a richer place, and those are the people who transport us further than our dreams.
Well, you've accomplished that. Anna, again, thank you so much. And for anyone who wants more information on Anna and her concerts and schedule, you could find her website, annapolonsky.com. Anna, again, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sylvia.
Here's Anna playing Shostakovich's Prelude, Opus 34, number 9. Thank you for joining me today. On our next podcast, I'll be talking with another extraordinary woman. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, iHeartRadio, and of course, our website, lifeofprey.com. Listen, subscribe for free, and take us with you wherever you are. This has been a Life of Prey production.